Hello, everyone. Before the show starts, I wanted to remind you that we're giving away a copy of Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All by Professor Martha Jones. Any buzzkiller who's a Patreon member already and supports the show that way can email me at info@professorbuzzkill.com, ask that their name be put in the hat for the drawing. And if you're not a Patreon member, please go to professorbuzzkill.com, click on the Support the Show button, and for as little as $1, you can join Patreon and put your name in the drawing for this wonderful, very important, and very, very relevant book to modern times. Now on to the show. Welcome, Buzzkillers. Here we are on Tuesday, September 8th, and I'm going to tell you in a minute why that's important. But it's also important because we have with us Dr. Martha Jones, who is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University. Hello, Professor. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're here to talk about your new book, which is coming out today, hence the September 8th sort of emphasis. And I want Buzzkillers to know that, of course, it's not only on the Buzzkill bookshelf, but one of the reviews of your earlier work lists you as being the political historian of African-American women. So we're absolutely talking to the right person, and we're talking to the right person about what I think is one of the most interesting books I've read in recent years.
Thank you for that. I think it's important to say that the work that I do stands on the shoulders of at least three generations of African-American women's historians who have been in the trenches, in the archives, and so deeply committed to the subjects that I have touched upon. But really, my work wouldn't be possible without that foundation.
Well, that's good to hear, and that's good to acknowledge. And of course, on the blog post that we put up with this show, we'll put some other references and other links to other books. But Vanguard is so fascinating, and I think one of the things that our listeners would like to know and would like to know more about, because I'm sure most of them don't know, is that we can go all the way back to as early as the 1820s to look at this first, you know, at the first generation of African American women activists.
Today in the 21st century, some of your listeners may have heard or may themselves invoke this notion, this theory of intersectionality, which is to say ways in which African-American women live and work and experience the world at the crossroads of racism and sexism. Right. And so one of my questions for Vanguard and in the research was to trace the origins of that idea. And while, of course, it becomes part of the almost commonsensical thinking in the 21st century, it turns out that Black women really develop that theory, articulate it, speak it, and work by way of it, right, going all the way back to the 1820s. So it turned out that in order to explain how we get to the 21st century, that's what historians like, isn't it? We have to go back 200 years, importantly, to some really, you know, path-breaking thinkers and activists among Black women who are analyzing their own circumstances and developing a politics through that intersectional lens.
So who are some of the early activists in the 1820s? I mean, it's absolutely right, and it's amazing to think it's 1820-ish to then 1920, the 19th Amendment. Now it's, of course, 2020, and we're still dealing with voting access problems. But if we go all the way back, who are some of the sort of pioneers or the founding members of that generation?
One of the women I write about is Jerena Lee. And Jerena Lee is important because she is one of these women who, out of her own circumstances, comes to see very clearly the problem of racism and sexism as intertwined in her own life. She is a Christian preacher, or aspires to be. She's a Black Methodist in Philadelphia in the early decades of the 19th century. She explains, called by God to preach the Gospels. And she engages in a struggle, both internal and external, around what it means for a woman to not only possess those aspirations, but to act on them, and ultimately to face the kind of ridicule that she is confronted by when she begins to take the pulpit. So Jerina Lee is somebody who really sets the stage for what turns out to be a very long, we could say a centuries-long struggle over the power and authority that African-American women can and should exercise within religious institutions. And for anybody who needs a reminder, Black churches are not a sidebar to African-American politics. They really are, for so much of Black history, at the center of African-American politics. So when Black women say they want a license to preach, or they want to be able to vote in a church conference, or they want to hold office by being ordained to the ministry, they are speaking the language of politics. They are offering up a kind of analysis that we understand is also applicable to the civil sphere. But Jerina Lee is one of those figures, even before we get to the abolitionist movement, is already speaking and writing in those terms. We know a lot about what she thought because she pens a wonderful memoir, a spiritual memoir, where she recounts her experiences and her great successes, but also the challenges she faces as a Black woman who wants to speak the word of God with public authority.
And where was she based? Where was this taking place?
She was based principally in Philadelphia.
Right.
And so she's born in a family, orphaned young, and is what we'd call in 19th century parlance an indentured servant for her young life.
Right.
But she will arrive in Philadelphia just as the man who will become bishop, Richard Allen, is helping to establish the Mother Bethel Church in Philadelphia, which is one of the denomination's, you know, iconic sanctuaries. But more importantly, he's on the cusp of establishing with others the new African Methodist Episcopal Church denomination. And Jerina Lee will be a member of his congregation. She'll spend a short time the wife of a minister. But when her husband dies and she's now a widow, she cannot resist the power of her calling and will spend her life traveling thousands of miles at great personal cost and at great risk. And all along the way will meet oftentimes with male church authorities, men who are ministers and lay leaders who are resistant. But she really earns a kind of following among Black women in Black Methodist circles, so much so that by the 1840s in that same church, women will now organize together to ask that church law be changed so that women can have licenses to preach. And they will, in 1848, they will actually win that struggle in the AME church.
That to me is interesting for a lot of reasons, one of which is that it seems to me an awful lot of suffrage pioneering, if you will, starts in these institutional reforms and saying, you know, we want to have more political say, more say in a church situation. But also then a little bit later, unless my chronology is wrong, about getting involved in, say, local school boards or local education institutions and choosing on a local level how schools are going to be run. Is that sort of the way that women are allowed to sort of gradually become more enfranchised in the broader sense of the word, because it's within their, if you will, sphere? It's within religion, it's within the home, it's within children, the sphere of children's education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I think it's an important perspective, but I think the way I would put it is that it's not merely or only a reflection of a notion that there is a women's sphere. It is, I think, not surprising that women begin to make and practice and do politics kind of where they live and where they are.
Right.
For African-American women, like African-American men, they are largely excluded from political parties, largely excluded from electoral politics, state politics, office holding, voting, and the like. And so we appreciate how African Americans build their own public culture and the kinds of struggles that might indeed have played out in a state legislature, play out right. in the spaces that Black Americans, men and women, occupy. You know, the church, the Black church in the early 19th century is imagined by many, perhaps by most male church leaders, to be a hierarchical and highly delineated space where men are in charge and women are subordinate. They're oftentimes termed helpmeets, is the term that is invoked in the early part of the 19th century. So even as we know that women raise the money, they fill the pews, they even run the Sunday schools from very early on in Black Methodist churches, that does not in any way suggest necessarily that they should enjoy any kind of power or autonomy, particularly no power over men.
Yes, and we should remind our listeners that, you know, politics with a small p can happen almost everywhere, that it can happen in a church setting, in any kind of institution, and political activity can happen anywhere where there needs to be reform. So you mentioned that she's one of these early women in the 1820s, but then she's also involved in the abolition movements as the decades roll on.
Not Lee herself, you know, she really will devote her career to Methodism and Christianity and to preaching, but she's a peer to Black women who indeed will enter public life through anti-slavery activism. In Vanguard, I write about another Black Bostonian, Susan Paul, who is by vocation a teacher, but with a distinct eye for the import of anti-slavery politics, who will be drawn into serving in local anti-slavery societies by the 1830s, be part of the world's women's anti-slavery conventions that happen in Philadelphia in 1837 and 1838. And it's another example of how Black women enter into politics, both the big ideas of politics, and anti-slavery is certainly a set of very big ideas about politics and power, but also about the mechanics of politics, right? What does it mean to convene a meeting, to call people to order, to preside over deliberations? What does it mean to speak from the pulpit? How does one do that? And Susan Paul is a wonderful example of one of many dozens of African-American women who are going through the invitation that is the anti-slavery movement, find their political footing, and again, bring a distinct perspective to that enterprise, one that does not cede the politics of gender for the politics of race or anti-slavery, but really insists upon, if you will, an intersectional or a holistic perspective on the principles that should undergird that movement.
Yes, and I think that's very clearly expressed in your introduction, where you talk about those women were, quote, the nation's original feminists and anti-racists, and they built a movement on those core principles and did it through intersection, well, essentially through being those two movements intersecting and becoming, you know, the biggest issues of the 19th century in the United States.
Absolutely. And anti-racist, you know, feminist is certainly 21st century nomenclature. Here I've adopted, I think, Ibram Kendi's very important intervention when he calls upon us in the 21st century to adopt an anti-racist position. I found that instructive for illuminating the bar that Black women are setting for American politics going all the way back to the years before, the decades before the Civil War.
And so how does that evolve as the 1850s start to become more and more heated, and then through the war? Is there just as much activity? Is there just as much energy in that movement?
Absolutely. You know, through the 1850s, African-American women continue their work within anti-slavery societies with some success and with some frustrations. They will be keenly interested in what we call the Colored Convention movement. This is African-American political organizations, local, state, and national, where Black leaders are coming together to organize and deliberate over the political questions of the day. By the 1850s, Black women are looking to make their inroads into those those conventions, upsetting those conventions when they present themselves and they present their ideas to that community. And the struggles in churches will continue into this period. All of which is to say that Black women are certainly, and here we're speaking principally of women who are free before the Civil War, right, that they are especially primed for the kinds of questions that will characterize the post-war period and the express questions about citizenship and voting rights that are on the table, not only within reform communities, but are on the table in Congress, the national table.
Sure.
Black women have been wrestling with those for a very long time. It might be worth at this juncture, and important, in fact, at this juncture, just to acknowledge my view of what the role that I think enslaved women are playing in this same moment. We know that enslaved women, by and large, are kept by law, by custom, by violence, out of much of what we think of as political culture before the Civil War. And still, in my reading, enslaved women are making their own record. That is to say, a figure like Harriet Jacobs, who will publish her memoir, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in 1861, will testify to her own concerns as a young enslaved woman in North Carolina. Foremost, Jacobs will explain the scourge that is sexual violence, sexual assault in the lives of enslaved women. And this is something that resonates even with free women who themselves experience vulnerability, especially when they travel, especially when they labor in the homes of others. And so this becomes a defining, if you will, issue for African American women early on, put on the table by enslaved women like Jacobs, but bringing us again all the way forward to Rana Burke's Me Too movement in the 21st century, African American women defining the substance of women's rights, defining the goals that we set for something like voting rights. It is out of a deep commitment to, if not solving, putting new tools in the hands of Black women when they face sexual assault or misconduct in their lives.
How do they handle the advent of the 14th and the 15th Amendments and during Reconstruction? Because we know, our listeners will know from earlier shows we've done, that those are very contested in terms of female suffrage. But it seems to me that you have this sort of dual blow of not only not getting the vote as women, but then later on not getting the vote as, not being able to exercise the vote as African-American women.
Black women understand well that before they will get to the polls, the nation will have to address both, if you will, racism and how racism and sexism are both embedded in American political structures, so that neither an amendment that empowers Black people nor an amendment that empowers women is going to do the job alone for Black women.
Yes,
that is clear.
Right. Yeah.
And I take my insights from, I think, a figure everyone should know of the mid-19th century, and that is Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, who comes to the 1860s as a poet, as a public speaker, as an abolitionist, who very much speaks from the position of African American women in debates with figures like Frederick Douglass and Susan Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Wendell Phillips. And she has many things to say, but two of them I'll foreground. One of them is she really urges these veteran radicals to adopt a political vision that really has the capacity to lift up everyone in the coalition. We are all bound up together in one great bundle of humanity is one of her often quoted lines. And this is a view that says we should neither give in to the exigency of sexism or the exigency of racism, that in fact we have the ability to set the bar very high for the nation's political culture and see the equality across humanity and insist that law and politics reflect that rather than fall short. So she sets a very high bar in these meetings is right. One thing. The second thing is that Watkins Harper, when she addresses the white women who are part of these meetings of the American Equal Rights Association in the 1860s, is very clear that she does not believe that the vote is, certainly it's not a panacea, certainly right. it is not the end of what ails someone like her. Watkins Harper is suspect of white American women, suspects that they may in fact use the vote to only further the influence of racism in American politics.
Right.
And so she really is very direct in her remarks to Stanton and Anthony. Famously, she says, you know, you white women speak of rights, I speak of wrongs. And here, what she knows is that in her own life, as a speaker and lecturer, as she travels, she is on streetcars, she is on railroads, she is being accosted, assaulted, thrown off of conveyances, asked to sit in a smoker car rather than right. in the ladies' car. And what she wants everyone to know is that white women and men mm-hmm. are witnesses to these heinous confrontations, and that almost to an individual, they do nothing.
Right.
So she is guarded and skeptical about women's votes because she understands that American women have been witness to her denigration and have not stepped up for women like her in everyday life, in these critical and terrifying confrontations. And so she inserts that perspective, right? Which is what it's not just, are you going to have the vote? What are you going to do with that vote? What are you going to do for people like me?
Right, right. Well, Professor, this is a good time for us to take a little break. And when we come back, I'd like to talk maybe about what happens with these groups during the Jim Crow era, and then, of course, into the 20th century. So Buzzkillers, we'll be back in a moment. Buzzkillers, you know that I love using the Great Courses Plus. It keeps me learning about the world. And as I've said many, many times on this show, my research specialty was British history. And so even though I am American, I tend to have forgotten a lot of the American history I learned as an undergraduate. And so not only does the Great Courses Plus keep me learning about the world, it keeps me learning about my own country and my own country's history. And they do that, of course, as you know, with engaging professors and experts. It's so easy to use their streaming service, their online service, and everything else they have. For instance, with this Vanguard topic that we're talking about in this show, I've noticed I understood Vanguard more and I enjoyed the book more by watching Black Capital, African Americans in Washington, D.C., which is an examination of the history and culture of African Americans in Washington, D.C., in the nation's capital. And also, The Great Courses Plus, Hacking American Elections, Why We're Vulnerable and How We Can Stop It by Dr. Paul Rosenzweig, who reveals not only how the 2016 elections were manipulated, but why we're still susceptible to that interference and what we can do about it. And as Professor Jones says in this show, we're talking about, you know, people have been hacked. People have been prevented from voting for longer than they've been allowed to vote in this country. So weaving in what we hear about Vanguard and what we hear about the African-American experience after the 19th Amendment, and weaving in things like Black African-Americans in Washington, D.C., and hacking American elections, you really get a full understanding of what's going on. And that's why I can't recommend it highly enough, right? They have a new app, the Great Courses Plus app. You can watch anywhere from any device, your phone, your iPod, your whatever kind of Kindle thing you have. It's just fantastic. Now, as always, it's the perfect time to sign up for the Great Courses Plus. My listeners can check out any course or lecture for free. For free. That's free access to their entire library. Don't wait any longer. Sign up today using my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. Yes, we're back here, Buzzkillers, with Professor Martha Jones, talking about her new book out today, entitled Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Dr. Jones, before we left, you were talking about the reforms and activism towards black women's rights and suffrage and all sorts of other things up to and including the Civil War and even during Reconstruction. Then what fascinates me as a historian, but as a non-American, if you will, is how things seem to get so much worse, maybe not worse in terms of being enslaved, but certainly seem to get... We have this triumphalist notion that once after the war is over and emancipation is achieved and the 13th Amendment has passed, everything is fine. But of course, we're now talking about stumbling into the terrible and inexcusable, as an American, Jim Crow era. How do these women, these black women on the vanguard, try to address those things?
Yeah, you've hit on a critical juncture in this story, of mm-hmm. course, which is to say that Reconstruction really marks a high point in many ways when it comes to the promise, the possibility of African American citizenship, of a true interracial democracy in the United States. But by the time we get to the end of the 1870s, that promise will not only be disappointed, it will increasingly be violently wrenched from right. Black Americans, as we see particularly white Southerners reinstituting laws and customs and extralegal violence, all in the name of the reassertion of white supremacy. So where are Black women in this story? I think there are two threads. One is that the women I write about will continue struggles that they had begun long ago for their political power in their own community institutions. So this is an era in which African-American churches will go through a kind of sea change, Baptist and Methodist churches in particular, where women will take on power and authority in ways that really are unprecedented. So the debates over women's rights and women's voting rights continue, but they continue in those Black-led, Black-controlled institutions in important ways. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the second thread is the coming together of African-American women's political organizations, what we often refer to as the club movement. So these are at one time local and regional organizations of benevolence mm-hmm. of in African-American communities that by the 1890s are going to become highly politicized, drawn together in a national organization, the National Association of Colored Women. And here we have, for the first time, a nationwide, tens of thousands of Black women strong political organization that exists right alongside, if you will, the major women's suffrage associations, which right. are also born out of the Civil War era. So African American women, again, working in there locally and even nationally in Black institutions, and at the same time founding their own base for politics, including suffrage politics, that will take them well into the 20th century.
And how does that happen? How do those organizations in particular, but Black women in general, work towards the eventual passage of the 19th Amendment?
So African American women, on the one hand, are going to gingerly and selectively ally themselves with right. women's suffrage associations. That is not an easy place to be and to work as an African American woman, because so much of what animates those organizations includes a large dose of anti-Black racism. But there are those women who are going to remain within those organizations. At the same time, Black women in their clubs are going to be engaged in, for example, citizenship schools and suffrage schools.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which is to say, in anticipation of the possibility of women's suffrage, Black women are going to prepare one another to face registrars, to get their names on the rolls. There's a lot of mechanics to voting. There is today, and there certainly was at the start of the 20th century. And so Black women are teaching one another, and men as well, better and better how to effectively engage with officials who are reluctant, resistant, and worse. It's important to remember that women's suffrage comes gradually in the United States.
That's right, yeah.
Piecemeal. So by the second decade of the 19th century, Black women are at the polls in places like New York and California and the state of Illinois, city of Chicago. So becoming part of party machines, they join the Republican Party in important numbers, create their own associations within the Republican Party to influence everything from the selection of candidates to platforms, and of course, what happens on election day. And the point really is that this work is happening not by way of or through national suffrage associations. That work is happening through the National Association for Colored Women.
But then after the 19th Amendment is passed and ratified, it seems as if, and again, this is overgeneralizing and compressing the chronology too much, but it seems as if then for the next few decades of the 20th century that states and localities can interpose themselves however they want in who can vote and who can't vote. And we see this, of course, in the Jim Crow era and the civil and reaction to it in the civil rights movement. So how I've often wondered how Black women and Black African-American men can keep their tempers for this long to when it comes to actually going to, as you say, the local registrar and showing up. And then eventually in the 20s, 30s and 40s being given all sorts of bizarre literacy tests and other types of things that prevent them from exercising this vote.
Oh, I think your phrase, right, you know, how do Black women keep their temper? I'm not sure they always do, right?
Well,
you know,
that
there's a great deal of outrage and outspokenness, a great deal of organizing and public organizing, a great deal of confrontation that Black women have long been a part of going back to the 1870s in a city like Washington, D.C., where they confront registrars and, you know, in groups and insist on the right to register. So there's a great deal of outrage and there's a great deal of confrontation. But I think you're right to point out that this is a long game, if you will. And that means that you need to work in all sorts of registers, and outrage is hard to sustain over years, decades.
But there must be the temptation an overwhelming temptation just to resign yourself to the idea that it's never going to get any better.
Well, I think the stakes are too high.
Yeah, okay.
For Black Americans, men and women. Remember that what we think of as the campaign for the 19th Amendment is a companion for Black Americans to the campaign against lynching and for federal anti-lynching legislation. So for Black women, yes, the vote is about power, political power, but it is for Black Americans perceived to be a question of life and death. This is what Frederick Douglass had said in the 1860s, you know, that Black men are being lynched. And hence we are going to seize this opportunity for the vote. But of course, we must acknowledge that women are also lynched, and women are, as we've talked about, subjected to sexual violence. And Black women believe that the vote is not the only remedy, but access to the polls, access to office holding, access to juries are essential instruments in ultimately defeating racial violence. And then, of course, as we move into the 1920s and 30s, as the Depression and the economic downturn of the Depression hits Black communities in ways that are far more brutal and far more lasting than they do other communities, again, Black women understand that political power is essential to restoring to their communities some kinds of modest economic possibility, economic stability. And so again and again, the nation presents Black Americans with many we might say, too many reasons to deem the vote essential and worth fighting for over time, because while it is not the only way to combat racial violence and Jim Crow, it is understood to be one essential dimension of that struggle. So I think Black Americans might, by and large, perceive themselves to have little choice. Now, it's important to say in the 20th century that African American political culture is not univocal and it's not one dimensional. And there is also an important and robust, and in this period, importantly, emerging Black radical tradition that will call into question, right, a more conventional strategy like a voting rights strategy or a constitutionally driven strategy such as that of the NAACP. Marcus Garvey will gather tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Black Americans and Black people around the globe into a Pan-African movement that is committed to self-determination and economic autonomy for Black people that does not depend upon and does not turn upon voting rights. We have the emergence of a Black left that will align itself with the Communist Party and very much alternative ways of thinking about power and politics for Black Americans and what's possible. So the vote is not the only thing on the table, and it's not the only route. And many of the people we associate with this period, be it, you know, a man like W.E.B. Du Bois or a woman like Mary McLeod Bethune, they're going to, if you will, engage with, partake, and take seriously a whole range of political visions and political routes to those visions. And voting rights and political rights and party politics is one thread of that story. That is the story that I principally tell in Vanguard, but it would be a mistake to think that that's the only, only story.
And I think it's also a mistake to think that, well, as soon as the reforms of the 1960s come in, you know, certainly the mid-1960s and even the Voting Rights Act of 1965, well, we've solved all that. That, that you know, it took a century, but we finally solved that. Because, as you point out, and lots of people have pointed out, it's just continually contested and chipped away at.
It's an exciting moment, though, I think it is, you know, 1965, because Black women do enter mainstream politics in new numbers and with, I would argue, a new kind of ambition, not because there have never been Black women who have sought office, there have been, and not because Black women haven't been voting for decades by 1965. But now there is the distinct sense that Black candidates, you know, a Shirley Chisholm elected in Brooklyn and then running for president in 1972 marks for us a moment in which Black women see their political aspirations, I think, anew. And it is an exciting time because indeed Black Americans are going to benefit from the sharp teeth of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and enjoy federal oversight and scrutiny of the individual states, which have long arbitrated, that's your point earlier, right, have long arbitrated voting rights. Now you have not merely constitutional amendments that are aspirational and without much teeth. Now you have a Voting Rights Act that civil rights advocates and Black voters themselves can use to maintain their access to the polls. And of course, that will be true until 2013, when the U.S. Supreme Court will, in essence, gut the most powerful provisions of that Voting Rights Act and contribute to our re-entry, if you will, into an era of voter suppression. I probably have gotten too far ahead of the story.
No, that's all right. And I think that points to the fact that there needs to be, or there has been, and there needs to continue and be re-energized a whole new movement of activism. I mean, I don't think most people have any idea about the 2013 changes in the defanging of the Civil Rights Act and that as a Voting Rights Act. And that's really a very distressing part of, you know, our current situation.
Well, and so as we look around, here we are in September of 2020. And as we look ahead to November, and we shouldn't have to wonder very long about right. how it is that someone who looks forward to voting in my state of Maryland as contrasted with a voter in, say, Georgia or Wisconsin or California, how we are all so very differently situated on right. any given election day, the differences between what it means to be a voter in one state versus another have only become chasms in these years. And we have, if you will, the Supreme Court's gutting of the Voting Rights Act to an important degree to thank mm-hmm. for a regime in 2020 in which your voting rights depend on very much on where you live.
Right. And that's that should be a clarion call, I hope, to all American buzzkillers out there anywhere who need, if they needed any more motivation than they already have to get involved in voting registration and driving people to the polls and voting activism on Election Day. That's another reminder. Well, it just remains for me to say thank you very much, Professor, for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We want to remind the Buzzkillers that the book is out today, September 8th, 2020, and that all of you Patreon members of the Buzzkill Institute, please tell me you'd like to have a copy of the book, and we'll put your name in for a drawing to receive a copy, a free copy, which we do with a lot of the books that we present on the show. So again, thanks, Professor Jones.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And we'll say to the Buzzkillers that we will talk to all of you out there next week.